Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Marcia Gagliardi, founder and editor of tablehopper.com and your moderator for tonight's Wells Fargo-sponsored program, The Perfect Cup, Coffee Talk with San Francisco's Finest Roasters. We're delighted to welcome three of the Bay Area's most celebrated coffee entrepreneurs for a discussion on what it takes to stand at the forefront of an artisan coffee revolution. In a moment, James Freeman of Blue Bottle, Jeremy Tooker of Four Barrel, and Eileen Hasse of Ritual Coffee Roasters will spill the beans on sourcing coffee directly from farmers they know, roasting on the premises of their local establishments, and brewing the perfect cup for coffee drinkers whose palates are growing more and more discerning. Before we officially kick off this conversation, a brief introduction of our guests. Imbibe Magazine's 2012 Coffee Professional of the Year and one of Fast Company Magazine's 100 Most Creative People in Business for 2013, James Freeman started Blue Bottle Coffee in the summer of 2002 in a 186-square-foot converted potting shed in Oakland. Blue Bottle now has 8 cafes, 3 kiosks, and 2 roasteries split between the Bay Area and New York City. Eileen Hasse grew up in New York and graduated with her bachelor's in religious studies at Brown University before talking her way into a coffee manager job in Washington, D.C. In 2005, she co-founded Ritual Coffee Roasters on Valencia Street in San Francisco with the intention of crafting the very best cup of coffee available anywhere. She sources beans directly from farmers, roasts in an aggressively light way, and brews coffee with down-to-the-second precision. And finally, named after a rare and very old four-barrel sample roaster, Four Barrel was launched in 2008 by Jeremy Tooker, who, according to the bold italic, is, quote, probably the only self-proclaimed hipster in the mission. He loves vinyl music, Italian road bikes, and sailor tattoos. His company is rooted in socially responsible buying practices, and he sees his relationships with farmers as the backbone of his tireless pursuit of the perfect cup of coffee. Please join me in welcoming three extraordinary coffee innovators, James Freeman, Jeremy Tooker, and Eileen Hasse. So this is definitely a panel and audience. I don't have to worry about being perky and alert. Woo! We have a lot of ground and grounds to cover, so let's dive in. I know. What is it about coffee? It's like coffee and laundromats. So many jokes. So first, I think we need to hear about your path to becoming the notable coffee roasters you are today. We'd love to listen to your individual stories about how you got immersed into the world of coffee. James, I read your book, The Blue Bottle, Craft of Coffee, and learned you went from the world of the clarinet to coffee obsessive. So let's hear more.
True. They're both obsessions in their own. But I was a clarinet player. I would play in local orchestras. I was good enough to get jobs that I didn't want, not quite good enough to get the jobs that I really wanted. So I would do a lot of driving. I would drive to Santa Cruz or Monterey or Modesto and play gigs and then come home. And it was not making me happy. So there was this kind of mini epiphany. I was roasting coffee on a perforated baking sheet at home and loving it. Because there was, at that time, around the time of the turn of the century, I sound very old. Around the turn of the century, it was very hard to get coffee, to buy coffee in coffee stores that you actually knew when it was roasted. And what was very exciting to me was how coffee was changing day one, day two, day three, you know, how the taste would change. And so I'd walk into a Pete's sometimes and I would like point to a bin and say, when did that come in? You know, Thursday. When did that come in? When did that come in? So I was kind of that guy at Pete's. And when they said yesterday, then I'd say, I'll take that. So, you know, it was this kind of wacky plan B. I was very, getting very unhappy and uninspired as a musician. And, you know, the expectation of being a musician is that you get to be inspired, you know. So I wasn't making a very good living and I wasn't inspired. I kind of felt cheated. And so I had this realization. It was a performance of Holst's The Planets. Does anybody know? Gustav Holst. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Very bombastic, and I just hated it. It was the second time I'd played it that season in a different orchestra, and the trombones were like right by my head. And And I just hated it, and I sort of made that decision in that moment that it was time to get out of what I was doing, and coffee was the only other thing I could think of. And you know, I shopped at the farmer's market, so that was a model of commerce I could understand. You know, you make something and you bring it to the farmer's market, and somebody gives you money, you give them that thing, and then tomorrow's another day. So that's what happened.
And got its claws in you.
Yeah. 11 years later, here we are.
Fantastic.
Being panelized.
Eileen?
My story starts with what you mentioned in the bio. My first job was in D.C. managing a coffee shop. And I had no business doing that job. I talked my way into it based on my experience of growing up in my sister's business, which is a gourmet food store. And there I fell in love with the business. I fell in love with running a cafe and being a part of people's day. And then behind it all, there's a math problem that you have to make work. And it's really challenging to make a coffee shop not lose money. And fortunately, my first boss sent me here to San Francisco in the year 2000 for the coffee conference. And it was there that I had the shot of espresso that changed my life. I was drinking coffee and making coffee up until, you know, for about a year at that point. And then I had a shot of espresso and a macchiato that were unlike anything I'd ever had. And I just hung out at the booth at this trade show, watching everything the barista was doing and asking him too many questions. And at the point where he was like, please, buy my book.
He said, no more coffee for you. No.
And that was a barista from Vivace, which is a coffee bar in Seattle and a roaster. So shortly after that experience, I actually moved to Seattle to get experience as a barista. And, you know, as soon as I had my, you know, it was really there that I had the focus on learning the craft of espresso, being a barista. But Seattle didn't really feel like home to me. And I was ready to open my own shop and came to San Francisco and just knew that San Francisco was home. And at that time, I was really pretty shocked at how San Francisco had an amazing food scene, amazing farmers markets, amazing access to ingredients, but the coffee scene was not what I was used to in the Northwest. So it was at that point that I decided, well, I guess I'm going to have to roast my own coffee also, not having any business doing that as well. So.
All right. And Mr. Jeremy.
My first job actually was in coffee when I was 17. I just moved back to Portland, Oregon, and I just needed a job to get me through school. I was actually I'm a high school dropout. I was trying to get my GED and didn't have any support from anybody, so I had to get a job and fell into coffee in a little town outside of Portland, actually. It was just the shop owner and myself, and what I didn't realize is that most shop owners don't roast their own coffee. They have a wholesaler or something. So I just thought it was normal fare that she would just roast all the coffee in the morning and we'd use it. And it was great. It was lovely. And I found out that it was from her father's farm in Honduras and this whole thing. So, but then she sold the shop about 6 months later, and I went and got a job at Starbucks because it was the only thing out there at the time. And my roommate was actually the manager, which is how I got the job. But because I wasn't very employable. But
you're like, I know someone.
So I started working the bar there, and it was shocking how little care that they were putting into it. To my standards, that's to say, at the time they were putting a lot of care into it compared to most places. This was back in 98, I guess. I knew it could taste better, so I just was trying to figure it out. And it was back in the manual days. They used these giant La Marzocco machines, and it was great. And so I just tried to figure out how to make it taste better. And the only thing I could really do was steam the milk properly and start doing latte art. And then they told me to stop, and I didn't stop. And then they fired me. And then it was very hard for my roommate. But and then I got a job at a place called Torfazione Italia, and where they cared a little bit more about that kind of stuff. However, the beans were a little bit behind a veil of the origins of where they came from. They had proprietary blends, but it was great, and I quickly moved up to management. It's actually where Eileen and I met, because we co-founded Ritual together in 2008, but that's, we were both working for Tor Fazio in Italia. It was great. I fell in love with you know, like the whole interaction with the live, like, boisterous environment of that, of those cafes, and it was lovely. I would spend extra hours there. I'd show up before anybody else, like an hour before my shift, and like fix the cabinets and do things just to make sure everything was going smoothly. Same thing. I decided to move to San Francisco because I saw a big void for the coffee, number one, and I love the city. So moved down and met Eileen and did Ritual, and then started Four Barrel in 2008. 2005 we started Ritual. So.
And yeah. Here we are.
And here we are.
So it sounds like mentorship can definitely play a big part in the craft of coffee, especially mm-hmm. here in where you started with your Honduran shop owner and roaster. I'd love to hear about some of the mentors who have shaped your paths and how. James?
I'm a little bit of a disadvantage because I've only worked in one coffee company, and that's this one.
Yeah.
But I liked that sense. It was exciting. You know, when I started, it was 2002. What's Blue Bottle's 1 year older than my son, Dashiell, who's paying very close attention to this lecture. Right, Dashiell? So it's 1 year older than Dashiell is. And so when I started, it was kind of nice. Before, like, these, like, voyages of discovery have kind of been ruined by the Internet. You can't really think you're thinking up anything on your own anymore, because somebody, you know, there's somebody who's 12 years old in Lyon, France, or Taipei that's thought of it first and posted it on YouTube. But at the time, it was very exciting, you know. So I felt like this was this very deeply personal voyage for me to figure out, you know, I had these very strong and particular tastes in coffee, and it was very inspiring for me to try to follow that path and not worry about who was doing what and when. But just my own personal mentors, my clarinet teacher is a very wonderful old man, passed away about 10 years ago, Rosario Matseo, played in the Boston Symphony from 1933 to 1966, left a very deep influence. And then he was the nice one, and then the mean one was Cal Opperman. He was in New York City. He passed away a couple years ago, and he was a great man and actually a very kind man once you got to know him. And so the sort of the looming specter of those incredibly talented and dedicated professionals that, you know, that were so deep into their subject matter and had lived so many decades performing at the very highest level, and they weren't afraid to do something 10,000 times, and, you know, and it seemed petty for you not to do it 10,000 times. So the concept of repetition and seeking some sort of beauty that's grounded in respect and art. I think, you know, I think about those old guys every day.
Nice. How much information would you say is shared between roasters and the coffee world? And how much of our local scene would you say is more open source versus secretive?
I don't think there are any secrets, really. Mm. Everybody thinks they can do it better, uh-huh. So it doesn't matter what somebody else is doing.
And I'd love to hear what does quality mean to you? What are some of your criteria? How does it affect the way you run your business? Eileen?
Sure. Well, at Ritual, we have a pretty specific point of view in what we're looking for coffee-wise. I would describe it as clean, sweet, and bright. And clean means the absence of defects, the absence of problems in the coffee, which sounds kind of obvious, but I would guarantee that probably everybody in this room has had a coffee in the last week that was not clean. Sweet is how much sugar is actually in the coffee. And then bright is the one that I think trips people up the most in a way. And the way to describe brightness is its acidity, like biting into a ripe peach. And to me, that's where a lot of the complexity comes in. And so you can have a really great coffee that's clean and sweet, but without acidity, it usually lacks complexity. It lacks something that's going to make it a memorable coffee. So that's usually what we're looking for.
Jeremy?
I guess we should say that there's a scoring system of how, you know, me as a coffee buyer, there's a system that we ascribe to, and it's based on points. Like wine, like when you score wine, it's 1 to 100. You know, we're calibrated with exporters and importers and everyone across the world. But that being said, it's also that was made by humans, and taste is being subjective. I oftentimes will score coffees that I would never buy very highly because it's just not my style. What quality means to me is for 4 barrels, what we're looking for is where those two meet, it meets our style of coffees that we're looking for, which is typically the brighter fruit coffees, fruit-driven coffees, all the way to the floral coffees can be. We don't really do the delicate coffees so much. Not that there's not a place for that, just not the 4-barrel style. But quality overall is driven by this point system. Means yes, there's absence of defect. And it's pleasant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we think a lot about, is this delicious? You know, cupping is one way to try to get an understanding of a coffee. But it's a limited way, and it's limited in the sense that most of our customers don't cup. So I try to make an effort to, we cup a lot of coffee. We also try to experience it in a number of different contexts. And, you know, at the core is like, is this really delicious? Do we love it? And there's a lot of ways to love it. We have some blends, we have some single origins, and we try to fit a context to a coffee. And, you know, is this going to work in this context or that? I like having a variety. We've got some beautiful, the coffee we were serving tonight is this beautiful tea-like, delicate, kind of peach snapple sort of thing. And I like having other things that are a little more muscular or you know, fit in a variety of, can hit a variety of places on the scale. So, but ultimately it's about deliciousness. And is there a way to prepare this or to make somebody happy with this?
Mm-hmm. So I'd love to hear from each of you about how you interpret each other's roasting style. On the scale of roast and from a flavor profile.
And you're looking at me.
You're closest.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a very clever question. Well, I was just at the mill a few weeks ago. That's Jeremy's new shop in Divisadero in my neighborhood. And, you know, I think Jeremy's point about it's not that his coffees are indelicate, but I don't think you're looking for sort of that, like, shimmery, evanescent refinement in everything. And even in the context of a macchiato, I think you got, like, a beautifully clean, sweet, but a muscularity. Mm-hmm. To it that I thought was very effective, and I like coffees with a point of view, you know, and mm-hmm. It was a really nice interaction. So that's how I would maybe categorize that: clean, bright, but not like over like the deposed Tsarina kind of elegance that some coffees get to. So hopefully that's not too off the mark.
No, that's great.
Okay. I'd like to jump in and ask James a question, because back many years ago, I feel like you described your coffee as, and I could be completely misremembering this, so feel free to correct me.
I will.
But I feel like you described your coffee as the gateway, or as a compromise between Pete's, which is the kind of the old Bay Area style, you know, basically being known for much darker roasting than any of the three of us on the stage. And perhaps my coffee, which is probably known as the lightest in the Bay Area, maybe even in the country. But I feel like it was a description of, you know, kind of being the midway point and a gateway.
Yeah, I'm skeptical that I used the word compromise, but I can, you know, it's plausible that I would use the word gateway. We have a few blends that I think are sort of that pleasant stepping stone. People come in and bound into our shops, and it's like, I like a Pete's French roast. Do you have anything like that? And, you know, truth be told, we don't, but we have a few coffees that sort of hit a few of those notes and could make somebody happy, maybe even happier than the Pete's French Roast that they're used to, but not be totally alienating mm-hmm. to them. So I would say, all in all, that's a reasonably fair characterization.
I would say, I mean, to go back to the time when you started, it was, you had a...
Tell me what coffee roasting was like when you started.
Exactly. Well, you started in 2002 with your own thing, and it was, at the time, there was a lot of, there was more blends focus, and it was great, and you did a lot of great blends. And I think that at the time when I was introduced to your coffee, you were doing, I was already against the dark roast, you know, and the whole thing, and before I learned the error of my ways, but then... I thought you did them really well.
Thank you.
That was wonderful. Mm. And it's been also lovely to see how over time you've expanded your offerings to be more single origin focused on the lighter side as well, and doing those very well.
Thanks.
So it's been very nice to see your business grow in great ways. So
it's kind of fun to just like chase your enthusiasms. Yeah. And I think we're all, doing exactly that. We kind of worry what people might want after we please ourselves with our coffees.
Your first coffees were actually the inspiration for the new brand we recently acquired at the De La Paz coffee roasters, and we're going to gear it towards like that the more of those stepping stones, because it's a huge market that nobody really caters to, I think, in the right way. Well, not nobody says as well, but I think that there's a really good spot for that as well.
Yeah, I agree.
You have all had some amazing growth. And I think it would be helpful for people to see just some of the nuts and bolts about your business and how many locations you have and where they are. We've got New York represent. and how many employees you have. And is this the current size of your operation? Was this part of your original plan, or is this just completely beyond your wildest dreams right now?
Yes, totally. There was no plan. I mean, the plan was to not play the clarinet, and in that sense, it's been very successful. 11 solid years of not playing the clarinet for a living. So in that sense, it's worked out great, and all the rest is kind of gravy. It's been amazing. I had no idea.
Really fabulous gravy.
Yeah. No, I'm so much happier doing this. It feels right, and all the doors that seemed so hard to open as a musician just seem to be like flying open in coffee, so it's nice.
So how many
and I met my wife at the
about?
Farmer's market,
That's right.
too. Well, I think your synopsis was correct. We've got 8 shops, 3 kiosks. A kiosk, in my personal definition, is something that doesn't have 4 walls and a ceiling. So the Hayes Valley, that's a kiosk, and Heath is kind of a kiosk, and the High Line is a seasonal kiosk in New York. And then 2 roasteries, and we're going to open a shop and a roastery in Los Angeles next year. So
super exciting.
There we are. Yeah.
And Oakland as well coming up.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm really excited. There's a beautiful building in a kind of a not sketchy, just sort of an odd neighborhood in Oakland. That is incredibly beautiful. It's a 1920s building, and it's, kind of untouched. It's not a historic building, which is also great. I think that's going to be a lovely spot.
Yeah.
Hopefully people will go to it because it's sort of not near... Well, it's near neighborhoods, but it's not in them. So we'll see how that all works out.
And besides, Eileen, you're 7 months along your own special construction
here. And different sort of project. So I have 4 coffee bars and a roastery. When we started, it was with the cafe on Valencia Street. When we began roasting, we roasted in the back of the cafe. And then about 2 years later, I opened a cafe out in the Bayview inside Flora Grub Gardens, which is the secret ritual. And then 2008, we opened up in Napa in the Oxbow Market. And the newest coffee bar is in Hayes Valley in a shipping container. And happily, the roasting is no longer at Valencia Street. It's in a standalone building in Soma. So we still roast in San Francisco. And so eventually I'd like to put a coffee bar or some kind of a coffee experience there at the roastery, because no matter what I do, I can't get it to not show up on Google searches. So people ring our bell almost on a daily basis, looking very confused at why it's so hard to find the coffee shop. So I'd like to figure out a way to serve those people.
Kiosk is imminent.
Yeah.
And then Jeremy just recently opened the mill.
Yeah, the mill in Divisadero is a lovely... It's actually in your neighborhood, correct?
Yeah, yeah. But as soon as the mill and the Byright opened on Divisadero, it's like my flat is worth 7% more or something
right.
like that. It's crazy. Thank you very much.
No, that was great. It's been busy since day one. The original location, so we only have two stores, but the original location, we keep growing, concentrating our efforts inward and looking at how we can do a better job at Forbrell. So, and it works really well. We do the equivalent of, in my experience, three or four cafes in that one location. So on the weekends, we push upwards of 2,000 people through that place, which is pretty crazy.
Those are amazing numbers.
Everyone's leaving with a smile, so it's not like we're just like herding them through the space. But most of our business is done on the wholesale side in terms of the volume that we go through. That's one of the secrets of Forbrell, that we are much bigger in volume than anyone realizes. And we've outgrown that little roaster, or it's the little roaster that could. It goes through 18 containers, which is crazy.
So. And just to do some math for everybody, because I had to ask you this. So if a container can hold 300 bags mm-hmm. at 130 pounds each, that's 39,000 pounds of coffee beans per container.
Yeah.
So times
it's
18.
Closer to 40 when they're all said and done. They usually get squeezed a little bit more.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Pack it in. So, and that's annual.
Yeah.
Amazing. Speaking of wholesale, I mean, it's certainly one way to get on the map. Is there a wholesale account that you landed that really made a difference in your business? Or maybe there's one that you guys were just really damn proud of, a place serving your coffee.
Yeah, wholesale, I think, is an interesting proposition just because, it is like a lot of coffee companies, they are mostly primarily wholesale coffee companies with sometimes a much smaller retail component. I love shops, and I like having our own shops and being responsible. And I also think that nobody really loves your coffee more than you do, you know. So wholesale is great, but it's also reminds me, there's this Albert Camus essay called The Myth of Sisyphus. And parenthetically, I was talking to a room full of MBAs, I will not say which school, and I brought that up, and one person had heard of Albert Camus. One. So, anyway, basically, the thesis of that wonderful essay is that Sisyphus is a very happy man, you know, because he knows the project that is ahead of him. And you have to kind of feel that way if you do wholesale coffee, because you have to feel like it's never ending. There's always somebody great that's at a location that's about to leave, and you're going to have to retrain somebody else. And so you have to be ready for that kind of arduous work and not ready for it, but embrace it, and it has to make you happy. Just in terms of, I love the Chemex service that's at Qua, which is a lovely restaurant, an inspiring restaurant. Our coffee's at Chez Panisse, and most of the time they do a very fine job, and when they don't, nobody can tell Chez Panisse what to do. So it's like Alice Waters kissed me right here one time, so that was a thrill. But you have to think of it in very sort of different terms than a shop. So for us, our shops are most of our business, maybe 70%, and 20% is maybe wholesale.
Mm-hmm.
The one that comes to mind for me is that we actually wholesale our coffee to a small coffee company based in Beijing, China. And they have 5 locations, but they probably go through the amount of coffee that one small coffee bar in San Francisco would go through. When they first contacted me, I was very skeptical. I was like, it's hard enough to manage the wholesale accounts that are right down the street from our roastery, where we can be checking in on them and providing them with a lot of resources. But the owner assured me that he would really invest in the training. He flew my trainer and me to China and we spent about 2 weeks there training the whole staff, helping them set up the shop, going over flow, you know, picking out cups, doing all the things to make sure that they were going to do a really good job. And, I get to see pictures on Twitter of what they're doing, and I've had a surprising number of customers come, you know, end up finding it in Beijing and coming back and saying, I can't believe I found your coffee in Beijing. That was such a great surprise. But it's just really exciting because they're having an impact on the coffee culture in China. And I'm excited to get to play a role in that. And their long-term plan is for us to help them start roasting their own coffee, not to keep importing it from us, which they're almost ready to take that leap. So proud of them.
So awesome.
Yeah.
Jeremy?
I guess the shops that I really connect with are the ones that I'm most proud of, and the ones which is most of them. I have to say that there are some like feathers in the cap ones that are great for exposure and to, you know, when people fly across the country to eat this one restaurant and they go in to see your coffee, that's great. But the ones that I really love are the small, like the small, really small coffee shops that do a really good job, and they're most of the shops that remind me of my first coffee shop, which is just a loud, you know, very tight cafe and often reminiscent of James's in the Hayes Valley. But Grand on Mission Street, which nobody really knows about, is one of my favorite cafes in the city. I go there when I'm not at Four Barrel.
And former bartender running it too.
Yeah, he's lovely, and he's
applies
cracking
some
jokes.
Some bad science to his drinks.
Yeah, he's such a great guy. And places like Reveille and North Beach, and where they really just do a great job. So we have one great place in Mountain View. It was a great account to get. So they were Volume, and they really cared, and they would send their staff up all the time for training. We have a pretty extensive training program, so it taxed our training crew quite a bit, but it was great. It was so lovely. So
awesome. So the relationship between roasters and farmers is getting closer and even more connected. I'd love to hear about how you source your coffee. Tell us about your buyers, brokers, and farmers. I know this is a big question, but I'd love to know how does direct trade play into how you source your coffee, and can you tell us more about how it works? I know this is a big one, but I think it's important. Fire away.
Yes, okay. We our longtime green coffee buyer just left, so if you were mingling here early on, you probably met Stephen, our new green coffee buyer. He's been around for a long time. I think there's a variety of great ways to buy coffee and a variety of horrible ways to buy coffee. You know, it's been interesting trying to chart that territory out for ourselves. But Stephen has a particular interest in East Africa, so he's been flying out there quite a bit and doing a lovely job there. And we've got a Brazilian coffee that should have arrived 2 months ago, but didn't. And I'm a little nervous because Caitlin and I were down in Brazil and went to the farm and cupped some great coffees, and that one's about to come. When I go on buying trips, I'm always very nervous because I want all the staff and everybody to like them, and oftentimes they do. So I think that direct model, there's a lot of potential for increasing ties and bringing more money and support to the people that are doing so much hard work down at the origin level. But also there's really great brokers in this world. There's really responsible brokers that have great ties with buyers. There's people like 90 Plus that are kind of brokers and kind of producers. There's a lot of different ways to get coffee into the States. And sometimes it makes me sad when I like broker is a kind of a bad word in certain parts of the industry, because I know a lot of brokers that do an incredible job and care deeply about sort of the conditions and the support of great farmers too.
Eileen, what's about your sourcing?
Sure. The way I would describe Ritual's sourcing program is collaborative. We do work directly with coffee farmers, but we're not looking, you know, every year to find, okay, who's producing the best coffee, and we'll cherry pick the best coffee from, you know, this group of farmers this year. What we're looking for is people that we can kind of bring into the Ritual family and work with year over year. And the benefit of that is that there gets to be this constant two-way communication. You know, we get to hear from our customers. We know what we're looking for. We know what our roaster's like. And we can be talking to our producers about what it is that we're looking for and, you know, workshop, in a way, with them how to achieve that. So the coffee that we were serving tonight from El Salvador, the Monterey Carrizal, Nancy, who is the producer of that coffee, is probably my favorite producer. I can say that. Hopefully my other producers won't listen to this radio show.
That coffee was phenomenal.
I'll send it to her. Yeah. But we've been working with her since 2008, and the way we found her was really by chance. There was El Salvador has a council for coffee, and it has a central lab, and she was in that lab cupping coffee. My coffee buyer was there, and it was relatively unusual to see a producer cupping coffee alone. Because seeing a producer cupping coffee to begin with is somewhat unusual. To see her struggling and figuring out how to do it alone was especially unique. So he kind of, you know, introduced himself and said, you know, can I help you? What are you doing? And she admitted that she was cupping for the first time, and she wanted to figure out what her coffee tasted like. And so he tasted it with her and gave her some feedback, and it was pretty good. And he was pretty impressed that she was relatively clueless. And she's an unusual story because most coffee farmers, especially in El Salvador, are, you know, it's something that's been passed down from generation to generation. You know, most of our coffee farmers in El Salvador are third or fourth generation coffee farmers. And she was somebody who at age 27 decided to buy a coffee farm and decided to learn it. And so she has owned her coffee farm for as long as I've owned Ritual, and there's a lot of parallels between us. But it's just been really exciting to work with her over, you know, every year, and, you know, she's really enthusiastic to figure out how to make the coffee taste better. We just had El Salvador week at our cafes where we serve nothing but El Salvadorian coffee, and last year we got her to come up for this, and this year we said, can you come again for El Salvador week? And you know, it was a mixed response when she told me, like, no, I really got to be on the farm. We're doing this new project, rebuilding some things on the farm. So I know the coffee is going to be better next year, but I missed having her here with us too.
Yeah. And Jeremy, you're off to Indonesia this week.
Yeah. I'm still one of the buyers. We have three buyers on our team, and we've been doing the direct trade, as we call it these days. Since we opened, it's actually at the core of our business is the buying practices there, and as James said, it's not that brokers are bad. It's just by my estimation and my experience, this is the best way to get the coffees that we're after, really. So it works differently in every country, in every place, and we have to go there 2 or 3 times, you know, every year to each of the places that we deal with, and it's great. It's great fun too. It's really an adventure sometimes, but really what we're after is the relationships and the coffee and help them improve. I was trained by my estimation, the best in the industry, this guy Tom Owens, who owns a business called the Sweet Maria's, and it's actually based in Oakland. He sells green coffee to home roasters. It's a very niche market, but he owns the entire market. He's the best at what he does. So. But he basically taught me everything, and he's been doing it for years, so I have a great perspective on how the entire market works, which is very complicated and very, very interesting. But we take a lot of time with our buying. I think we put it together last time when we calculated about someone's in the field 9 months out of the year, which is crazy. Tal's about to have a kid, so I got to pick up the torch again because my kid's old enough to travel with me now, so I'm taking him to Africa this year.
Camping in Ethiopia.
Yeah, his passport's like pretty well stamped, but it's really great. And the other thing that connectivity does for us, and being that 100% of the coffees that we buy are direct, and direct meaning that we actually we negotiate with the farms. They know exactly what they're getting. We know how much exactly we're paying, and we still use all those middlemen. We just negotiate. That's when we negotiate down on the other ends, and you'd be surprised at how big of a markup the middlemen can take. Sometimes undo with the market spikes. They'll get that if things weren't properly hedged. They'll get that. So it's interesting. But next year, as we're now that we're the size that it makes a lot more sense that we can do more of these social impact projects. We can actually attach a dollar amount to our coffees that go directly back to a project that not necessarily impacts the coffee quality, but usually will impact the community around that cooperative or that farm. We did a project a couple years ago that built a new kitchen for a school that they had built. The kitchen was in horrible disrepair, and we attached 50 cents at the time. Was a lot for us to try to convince people to pay an extra 50 cents per bag of our coffee, but it sold out pretty fast, and we built a kitchen for the school, and it was great. So we plan on doing a lot more of that stuff this year, and we can only really do that because we have a relationship with those people.
Yeah, that actually does tie into one of my questions about the fact that many of the regions that you source coffee from can be impoverished or in need of investment and assistance. And I would love to hear more about any social enterprise efforts or charitable work that your companies have done or you're working on. Eileen, you just actually told me about how you donate a lot of your coffee actually to homeless shelters.
Thinking, we've done a lot of different projects over the years, everything from there was a program in Brazil that was a really similar. A school had a great music program, but they didn't have any musical instruments. And just spending time in Brazil, you know how important music is to the culture there. So that was an exciting one. The other one that came to mind is more quality related, but there's a farm in Costa Rica that we've been buying from now since 2007. And they, in 2006, before we started working with them, decided to go organic, but they didn't really know what they were doing. And so it really damaged their farm. And we had that first harvest that we bought from them was amazing. And then the next year, their production was really low, and it was really low quality, and it was obvious that the farm was suffering. But they didn't really, at that point, have the money to reinvest in it because they had also just come off of a really small year. So we've been working with them ever since, buying the majority of what they produce. And just last year, we committed to helping them replant the entire farm over the next 5 years. So we're in year two of replanting the farm. Which is crazy because some of that coffee we won't even see for the first time for another 9 or 10 years. So that's pretty long-term commitment there. Yeah. But it's having an impact on, on their family in a really big way. And that's crucial, especially in Costa Rica, because there are a lot of people in Costa Rica are leaving the coffee industry. There are American-owned factories there that pay pretty well. There's now a huge real estate problem in Costa Rica where people are able to make more money selling their real estate than they are working the land for coffee. So to me, anything that where the next generation can see that coffee is a viable career and that they can actually make a living wage or better on it, and keep them farming is crucial to me.
So. And James?
Yeah, we've been working with this wonderful woman, Myra is her name. She actually lives and works part of the time in Oakland, at the Port of Oakland, but her family's from Honduras, and we've been working with her, I think, 3 or 4 years. A couple of years ago, our green bean buyer at the time, I really believed in this small co-op, and he wanted to go and help them set up a cupping lab because they hadn't drunk their coffee. A lot of farmers never cup their coffee. And so we went down and helped them set up a cupping lab, to help them, get into the routine of cupping their own coffee so they could, grow better coffee and see why things are buying, why things are selling, why certain other things aren't selling. And it's that sort of, what's the corny phrase, teach a man to fish kind of approach that so far has been helpful.
And I'd be curious, organic certification is particularly important to Blue Bottle.
Yeah, it didn't occur to me to not have it be important because as a farmer's market shopper, that's this boy is like has been fed on mostly organic stuff. And there are problems and limitations of organic certification at origin in some cases. So it's not a perfect certification. There's no certification. But both of our roasteries are certified organic, and it's maybe 70%, 75% of our production is certified organic. And what a lot of people don't know is what that means. Certainly there's a paper trail, and there's certified farms and certified mills and certified container ships, and there has to be a paper trail all the way along the line. But what doesn't, a lot of our customers will ask and talk about it, the certification that ends up in our roastery, they talk about what kind of pest control management that you're doing. They're talking about what kind of cleaning products, making sure. And I think that's a really important part of organic certification. It's not just the product itself. It's the facilities in which it's produced have to achieve a certain standard that's inspected yearly. And I'm not very good at sort of getting that kind of message out. But that when we started going through that process of certification of our facilities, that seemed like very germane and important and poorly communicated to the world.
Jeremy, do you have anything to add?
No, Forbrell doesn't. We're not certified organic. Mm-hmm. We don't really. I see that system being broken in a lot of places in coffee. I think in every other instance, in getting in the U.S., from getting produce from your locally is great, and that works, and that's a really good way. We can do all those things, and we can do all those things that people ascribe, and we can do them even better than what's required, and that's oftentimes we do. Some of the systems are broken. Well, I know for one, like in Ethiopia, like you can get any farm certified organic. Really, they've never used pesticides. They look at you like you're crazy if you ask that question because they just can't afford it. And so there, and like where some other places, organic certification means that they're getting rid of their waste responsibly as well. But not so in Ethiopia. And in Ethiopia, it actually, if you're a certified organic roaster, they won't show you the good stuff if their coffee is organic, because they'll save that for the organic certified only buyers. And if they just happen to be, if we walk in and they're like, oh, we know we've heard of you. Here's our stuff. You can have first crack at these different lots. And the other part of it for me, that way we don't stamp, we don't really we care about that stuff is it plays into a system of greenwashing that I'm really opposed to. And like that's when I say direct trade, I use quotations because it means something different for every company. And it's sometimes abuse system too. Those are things that I don't feel like I should have to put labels on my bags to sell them. Not that I'm against any of that stuff. And we go on the farms and we know that they're not using pesticides. We know they're doing it responsibly, and we help them start up compost programs, and we encourage that greatly. And then sometimes it's going to be a problem. Problem this year with a lot of the organic farms is leaf rust, coffee leaf rust. And some of those organic farms, if they don't protect themselves, they're going to get hit, and they're going to be decimated and possibly go out of business. We've been talking about trying to get people to use copper early on, and that can be in the certification is can work. But a lot of these people are using these crazy systemic fungicides but they're saving the coffee farms. So who's to say that that's bad if they're going to save their coffee farm because of it? I don't want to make that call. So it's a hard one.
I'd love to jump in.
Yes.
I have a different perspective. We actually just got our organic certification this year. And the reason we decided to pursue it was that there were a handful of farms that we've worked with for several years that were organic. And it was a little bit frustrating. Like, we had to limit how much of their story we were telling when we were selling those coffees without being able to call it organic. So for us, it didn't signal any change in the buying. The buying is still driven by tasting and what's in the cup and how does it taste without hearing any of the story or knowing where it's from or knowing if it's organic. But ultimately, in some places, it's a lot easier to do organic than in other places. And in those places, then we get to tell the whole story now, and that is a lot more satisfying.
I'll say that, like, probably one of our best relationships that we have in Colombia, this guy had a farm, and it was La Cabana. It's a beautiful coffee, and he was certified organic when we started buying from him, and it was great. It was the most beautiful farm, and then they got hit with coffee leaf rust, and he had to drop his certification, but he saved the farm, you know, because his neighbors lost their farms in a great way. And this is a coffee that's really high in elevation. For those of you who don't know, like, it's working its way up to those higher elevations where it doesn't thrive as well, but it's getting there. So it's a really hard thing to do. And we decided that we wanted to buy this coffee anyhow, even without that certification. We ended up paying him more for it. So just to promote him to keep his things going. So he's back on track to getting certified. That was just the 1 year, but anyway, he had to spray his farm down. So
I'd love to hear a region that you're all really excited about and want to explore more. What are you seeing as something that's kind of a place that you see as being up and coming?
Well, I think there's some really amazing coffees. Well, there's so many great coffees in this world, but I'm just super excited about Rwandan coffees lately. Stephen, our new buyer, knows a lot of people there, and so he's got better connections. And got a couple lots this year, and we're actually perhaps going to buy what could be the very first certified organic coffee coming out of Rwanda. They missed their inspection deadline this year. We might buy it anyway, and it could be next year. But I just think that it's some incredible coffees that I've been tasting from Rwanda.
I can't limit it to just one origin.
Yeah. Go ahead.
For us, Bolivia is a new origin. We just sourced from Bolivia for the first time this year. But I'm still really excited more about El Salvador, just because that's a country where we work really directly with the farmers. People are really excited about doing experimentation. It's a lot of really small farms, so you can have a handle on exactly what's going on. And so that's still very exciting to us.
And so you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Tonight's program on Bay Area Coffee Innovation is sponsored by Wells Fargo. Our panelists are James Freeman of Blue Bottle Coffee, Jeremy Tooker of Four Barrel Coffee, and Eileen Hasse of Ritual Coffee Roasters. I'm Marcia Gagliardi, founder and editor of TableHopper.com, and your moderator for the discussion. At this time, I'd like to remind our audience that you should feel free to line up at the microphones to ask a question live of our panelists. And I'd love to hear, actually, Mr. Globetrotter, how about you? What's an origin you're really excited about to explore?
Oh, God. Well, this year we're stepping into... Last year we outdid ourselves in Ethiopia. It was great. I was super happy with all the coffees we got. We work with a project called TechnoSir, which is an NGO that works out there, does some amazing projects that start from scratch. Impacts communities greatly. It's a pretty amazing project to support. They're stepping into a few different places this year. We're trying to sneak across the border this year, possibly into DRC, Congo, which is, you know, talking to some of my buddies who are from the military, they're wanting me to wear my flak jacket, but it's not like that anymore. There's some I've tasted some beautiful samples from there. That's great. Malawi is another great one. East Africa is my baby. I love it there. It's the most exciting place. And different parts of Ethiopia, even though we know there's some, the famous Yirgacheffe area and Sadama out of the west is where we stepped into a couple of years ago, and that's pretty great. And now there's like even micro regions within that are so different from, you know, 5 miles down the road, 10 miles down the road in terms of profile and the plants and the varieties. It's incredible. So. I'm just excited about all of them, really.
So it was funny, when we were in the green room earlier, I wanted to check with each of you about the roasters that you all use, which are all vintage Probat roasters. And I'd love to hear about the strong appeal of these vintage machines for you, and why you think roasters are so wedded to them instead of trying something newer.
We're actually, for LA, we're looking a lot at a new roaster by Giessen, which is a German roaster. But I like old gear in general. I like old stereos. I like old espresso machines. I like old cars. I like old roasters. There's a certain romantic appeal about something that you're not sure if it's going to break.
Mm-hmm. walking the line.
Yeah. At a certain point, though, is it the piano or the player? You know, I think there's a good roaster can coax a good coffee from just about anything. But, you know, there's an allure about these cool old machines that I think is pretty pervasive in the industry.
Eileen, Jeremy, are you wedded to the ProBots for quite a while, or do you poke around to see what's...
We're actually checking out the Giessen as our next roaster also. Hoping to get our hands on one to test it out.
I love modifying machines, and that's like one of the things that ProBots are so great about. You can add a bunch of the new Finkel equipment on it, and then, or you can just keep it as is. We do a hybrid of the two where we put some probes in some places, and it helps us dictate some of the changes and information. But they just have so much history, too. We're shopping for some very big roasters right now, but we're sticking with the ProBats just because, honestly, they're a lot more affordable, too, if you get to a certain size.
So let's dive in about our local coffee scene a little deeper, too. there's the oft-heard lament that coffee is becoming too elitist, and especially in San Francisco. What do you want to say to those people?
I don't hear that lament in our shops. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm assuming you guys don't either.
You know, not people, in the shops.
Yeah. No, people want something really delicious.
Maybe on Yelp.
It seems like a lot of them are coming to our shops for that very reason, because there's something really delicious that makes them happy for less than $5. You know, that's amazing.
I agree.
Yeah.
No, I think there's a cafe for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of San Franciscans like to complain, but...
What I will say is the coffee drinkers of San Francisco have gotten significantly more sophisticated in the last 8 years that we've been open. The questions that people ask when they come in to buy a bag of coffee are so different now than they were 8 years ago. 8 years ago, it was, what's the darkest? Now it's, I had this varietal, or I had a coffee from here. What's going to be the most similar to that? It's great. It's fun.
It's. I remember last year, two firemen in line at our shop at the roastery in Oakland, and we had this producer that we've worked with for quite a while, Ada Batley from El Salvador, and we had three or four different processing methods that she did of this one coffee, and they were like in line, and one guy says to the other, it's like, oh, they have a pulp natural. Did you try the washed last week? I was like, wow, that is so wonderful. And the guy's like, no, I did not try the washed last week. Let's try it. Let's get the pulp natural this week. I think that's wonderful that people are delving into their pleasures. Why shouldn't we be enthusiastic and educated about our pleasures, you know?
And so I think it's interesting how coffee is so polarizing in San Francisco, and many people identify as being a blue bottle coffee drinker, or they're loyal only to Ritual or Sight Glass, and we don't see that maybe so much with beer or wine. But what is it about your brands that have such strong hardline allegiances?
That's such a tough question.
Who's
your customer?
Is it about our brands, or is it about the nature of coffee itself?
I think it's the nature of coffee. I think that it's the fact that you're dealing with, you know, somebody's Ritual. You're dealing with, you know, people in a very fragile state.
They're vulnerable, you know. They haven't had coffee yet.
I don't leave that. I don't leave the house. And I don't understand people who like go out for their coffee in the morning.
Before I have
So I think it has to do with that. I think you're not maybe, you know, when it comes to drinking beer or picking a restaurant or even saying which pizza is your favorite in town, you know, you might be a little more open. But first thing in the morning, you might be a little, you know, you want what you want.
I think with coffee, it's different than other foods because there's this imputation of expertness that when somebody makes something every single morning for 10 or 20 years, they become kind of an expert in their own minds. And nobody, like when we go to Café Jacqueline, I don't think, oh, you know, when I make souffles at home, I do this or that or that. You know, but if because people make it at home, even if they're deeply misguided in how they make it, they sort of, that informs their preferences too.
So I'd love to hear just from each of you about some of your cafe roles and why they exist. I think some people need to understand maybe why you don't have soy milk or only whole milk, no cappuccino, why you won't grind beans. I think it'd be helpful to just go over a few of the rules and how you balance hospitality and having house rules. Jeremy.
I get a lot of flack for this all the time, so my rules are very stringent. I actually sometimes change them. So we recently switched to almond milk and ditched the soy, and it was nothing more than me just not really liking soy. And then I figured I had to question myself. I was like, why did I even do soy? Oh, because it's expected. I want to do almond milk instead as a dinner alternative because I liked it more. So I think that like my rules apply to the cafe just because that's the way I want the coffee to be represented, and we spent such a great deal of time trying to find these coffees that fit our profile and roast it to that profile. And it would be, in my opinion, a shame to mask that experience and rob you of that experience of all the time that we spent on it. But but that's also, you know, if you want to take it home and do it differently, be my guest.
Not also, my watch.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, it is a more purist approach, and often I totally understand, like, we get the elitist thing, but just because of that and not having spun down stuff, but it's also, it's just that stuff, less stuff to deal with, and I just don't want to deal with it. I'm trying to truth be told.
What's one thing that you wish all customers would understand or know?
About us personally or
Yeah. The first thing for me that comes to mind is that coffee is hand-picked. That every cherry is picked individually off of a branch and put into a basket or a bin or something, with very few exceptions. Brazil is one exception. There's usually mechanical harvesting in Brazil. But with the exception of Brazil, it's just, to me, that's incredible. And even, you know, I spent time on a friend's farm up in Napa picking grapes. And up there, you cut the branch, and then later on, you sort out everything that's not a grape. But with coffee, it's literally, you know, only the ripe cherries that come off the branch. And it takes a lot of coffee cherries to make a pound of coffee. And so just kind of having, you know, some idea of that, people could understand that anyway, that would be amazing.
Coffee is harder than it looks. It really is.
I think people should pay more for it. It's true, though. I think that in general, I think in the U.S., we don't pay enough for food in general. I think that the cost of production is a big thing, and that's one thing we can. Another thing we can do by doing this direct stuff, we know what the cost of production is, and as a coffee buyer, have a responsibility to keep the price reasonable. But I also would love to, you know, we only do prices that are profitable for the farmers as well. But it's still, I mean, we're talking, you know, still only dollars for a few dollars a pound. So I think that with as much time and attention as being paid to these coffees, they deserve a lot more.
Okay. So a question from the audience here was, when will the coffee shop bubble burst?
You tell me.
Yeah.
Never. I mean, I see cafes of a certain vintage sometimes closing and then being replaced by cafes that use one or the other of our coffees that are maybe charging a little bit more and making coffee to more stringent standards. And you know, according to Euchers, this book called All About Coffee, in the 1590s in Cairo, Egypt, there were 3,000 cafes, you know, for a population of a couple million people. Mm-hmm. So I think we've got some work to do. We've got to add. Yeah.
We have someone here with the microphone. Question.
Hi, my name's Austin. You three have three very successful companies, but what was the hardest part of getting where you are today?
Oh, God.
Picking a name.
Yeah. It's hard.
Picking a name was really hard.
Which was actually one of the questions here, so.
probably the time it took to get to where we are, and for me, that it was probably the sacrifices I made. I spent a lot of time away from my son. We opened Four Barrel 2 months before he was born, and it was really difficult. It was actually after he was born. I had to put the project on hold because there were some complications in the delivery. But then I stepped away. I started buying, and I missed out a lot of stuff on the first couple of years of his life, and it was really, I feel really guilty still. But it's. Now I can make choices that are otherwise. Now I can work. I work a very reasonable 40, 50 hours a week, and I'm about to take my first vacation tonight.
Progress.
Actually leave. So that's great. So my priorities have shifted since then and looking back. But it took a lot to get there. So
another quick question here, microphone.
Sure. And I'm curious what opportunities you all see in international markets, either wholesale or retail, and especially for domestic consumption in the countries where the coffee is produced.
I think that the producing countries, there's a lot more these days that are being consumed in the countries, which is a great sign. Depends on the culture. Only 50% of the coffee in Ethiopia is exported, and the rest of it is for in country consumption. But we get approached all the time. I'm sure you guys do as well for Philippines, for other emerging markets. But wholesale is something I would never want to touch on in that realm because it takes a lot of time and effort. But
there's 23 million people live in Sao Paulo, and there's one really good cafe. So
there's a huge potential for that.
Yeah,
definitely.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the end of our program. I want to thank Wells Fargo for sponsoring this program, and to our panelists, James Freeman of Blue Bottle, Jeremy Cooker of Four Barrel, and Eileen Hossie of Ritual Coffee Roasters. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club series on small business success stories, sponsored by Wells Fargo. I'm Marcia Gagliardi, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.